Blog Talk Radio.
Somebody who's really strong.
today. We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world with the rule of law, the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of men. When we are successful, we will be. We have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which the credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision.
Romney wins Florida, 93% vote for war, death, and against Paul.
Yeah. Republican crazy bastards. All right. Let me play this. This is only about 4 minutes long, but this is Mitt Romney, who is the winner of the Florida primary. All right.
Of course, he bought his win.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, who would win? I mean, Ron Paul didn't have a chance down there. But Mitt Romney wins Florida, and now the race changes pace, right? And listen to this. This is from Huffington Post.
I'm Mark Blumenthal, senior polling editor from the Huffington Post, here on another week with another Republican primary, except this time a convincing win for Mitt Romney.
Now officially closed in Florida, and Fox News can project that Mitt Romney will triumph in the Sunshine State, taking all 50 of Florida's delegates.
So what are the factors behind Romney's victory in Florida? First, Romney and his allied super PAC were able to outspend Gingrich and his PAC by better than 4-1 on Florida's airwaves, airing some pretty tough negative ads, including one that was lifted from a decade-old NBC News broadcast narrated by Tom Brokaw, and it aired despite NBC's objections.
Tonight he has on his own record the judgment of his peers, Democrat and Republican alike, by an overwhelming vote. They found him guilty of ethics violations. They charged him a very large financial penalty, and they raised serious questions about his future effectiveness.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Second, in contrast to South Carolina, Gingrich put in performances in nationally televised debates that disappointed pundits. He often wandered off message talking about topics like a base on the moon.
I spent 25 years in business. If I had a business executive come to me and say they wanted to spend a few hundred billion dollars to put a colony on the moon, I'd say you're fired. The idea that corporate America wants to go off to the moon and build a colony there, it may be a big idea, but it's not a good idea.
And although Gingrich was endorsed by former Senator Fred Thompson,
I have come to the growing realization, for me anyway, that Newt Gingrich is the guy who can articulate what America is all about, American exceptionalism.
And former candidate Herman Cain, a series of endorsements promised from members of the House and Senate failed to materialize.
I hereby officially and enthusiastically endorse Newt Gingrich for President of the United States.
Combined with well-regarded efforts by his campaign to turn out early voters, added up to a Romney victory.
NBC News can project that Mitt Romney will win the Florida Republican presidential primary. Newt Gingrich is a distant second.
Now the pace of the campaign changes a bit. Over the next week, we'll have caucuses held in Maine, Minnesota, Nevada, and Colorado. All those are states where Romney did very well, in particular in Nevada in 2008, where one in four voters were Mormon, who voted 95% for him. On the other hand, the caucus states have been targeted all along by the Paul campaign, who think they'll have an advantage turning out their especially enthusiastic voters to participate in low turnout caucuses. There's also a non-binding beauty contest primary in Missouri that doesn't choose any delegates, but Newt Gingrich isn't on the ballot there, and Rick Santorum is benefiting from some of the media and attention he got in next-door neighbor Iowa, and he leads in at least one poll there.
You say that Missouri's got a big role to play in the process, and yet they don't have any delegates there, do they?
They don't have delegates in this primary. They have a caucus coming up in about a month after the primary. But, you know, it's a primary. People are going to go out to vote. Everybody's always looking at what do the polls say. Well, the best poll is, you know, folks one of the most important states in the country in the general election is going to speak.
And then we have a bit of a lull. No debates and no more primaries until the end of the month when there are primaries in Michigan and Arizona, both of which are potentially very strong states for Mitt Romney. Michigan, where his father served as governor, and Arizona, where the population of Mormons rivals that of Nevada. The question for Newt Gingrich is, what does he do over this next 4 weeks if Romney and potentially Paul or even Rick Santorum are winning and he's not? Is he able to raise enough money and build organizations to compete in the southern primaries that will happen on Super Tuesday in March?
Anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting because it had a
good overview there.
Yeah, here's something different, too. And this is the Pitchfork movement in revolt, Western media blackout.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Let's go to the main story.
Yeah. I thought this was an interesting story because it's something we haven't heard about.
This is from Poor Richard's blog.
Actually, in Sicily.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, we've been blacked out here by so much stuff, even the internet. But let's move on. On January 16th, middle-class Sicilians began a popular uprising, appropriately called the Pitchfork Movement.
Movimento di Furconi.
There are shades of the Occupy movement within it, but the core is not dissatisfied, unemployed youth with no property or business to lose. They are middle-aged and older. They know that what they have left has been targeted by their own elites to bear the economic pain.
The other difference is size. Sicily's 5 million people, their grassroots people, have occupied themselves. So, of course, the story caught my eye, and I checked the mainstream media sites to look at what I was sure to be some great video. Wrong. So far, there's almost nothing. I went back to check my date, and yes, it started on the 16th, and it took 2 days to shut the island down, nothing going in or out. That was almost 2 weeks ago, and I just learned today, and I can assure you, I am not a hermit. Can you imagine the Occupy Wall Street people having shut Manhattan down for 2 weeks with no European coverage? Sure, it's Sicily and not Manhattan, but it's big, 25,000 square kilometers. This is what I use the space station feature photo. What could corporate media possibly be afraid of? Well, grab your seats, and here it is. The arrest of all corrupt politicians, reduction in the number of parliamentarians, removal of the provincial bureaucracy, local crooks, as most of these politicians have been there for over 40 years, drastic cuts in their salaries and privileges of parliamentarians and senators, restricting politicians to only 2 terms in office. Now, there are some radical ideas. They must have come from some anarchist aliens that landed in Sicily during the night, or it sounds like we all have a common problem that requires a common solution, which requires that we might want to start working together. That sounds like another radical idea. But veterans today would be happy to offer a platform for such an exchange.
And this is from
Poor Richard's blog.
Poor Richard's blog, yeah.
Yeah, you...
Oh, sorry. There's hundreds of trucks. Oh, where were we? Did we pass it?
Okay.
Oh, foreign exchange. There is one YouTube video that I found with only a whopping 47 views. Now, that's what I call getting the word out. Yeah. I mean, really, in Sicily, on everybody's hate list or something, did they do something really bad? Maybe I am a hermit and just don't know. You might need to turn me into Gordon.
Today is the third day, I don't know what that means, of protests in Sicily. The island is almost paralyzed. In the island are protesting truckers, farmers, fishermen, craftsmen, and merchants. Students are organizing demonstrations in solidarity, occupying roads and harbors. In Gela, they close the entrance to the refinery, threatening the port operations. Hundreds of trucks are at Villa San Giovanni harbor trying to ship to the big island with tons of goods. Fruits and vegetables and dairy supplies will soon putrefy because the trucks cannot reach the shores of Sicily Island. This stop is having a price on Sicily in terms of loss in the economy. The stocks of fuel are scarce, and in many areas of the island are over the same for food, with empty shelves in supermarkets, and some smaller businesses are already closed. People are starting to fear the food that comes from the black market. Truck infantry is escorted by police. Sicilian middle class take to the streets.
Protest against increases in fuel, 40% taxes on top of the basic price.
Gee, what do they think they are, Connecticut?
Yeah, really. The road toll, but this is just the top of the iceberg. The leaders of the movement speak of a cry of despair and revolt of the workers on the island. This is not an unusual, or this is not an usual mobilization that gathers social sectors and political groups that have little in common. Waving separatist flags next to the Forza Nova, or the extreme right movement, the risk of exploitation is as high as always very high. Even more in a region like Sicily, perhaps the one that most supported the center right government led by Berlusconi, who has led the country to bankrupt. Many people believe that fascists and mafia are behind and within the movement. There are those who ask the promoters of the protest to distance themselves from people linked to the crime, who are seizing the movement to the moment to join the protest as victims to have a sort of control. Prosecutors in Palermo confirmed the possibility of such suspicions, but it is unknown whether there are already ongoing investigations.
As Veterans Today has been stating over and over, if the good folks want to take on the deeply entrenched elite mafias, they have to set aside their petty differences that historically absorb 95% of the political activism energies. They have to save the home front, or they're going to have nothing to fight over other than working for the mobsters to hunt down those who still have something to steal. Yesterday, I listened to a wonderful Al Jazeera interview with Tunisia's new prime minister, Hamadi Jebali. The big question asked was, how had the moderate Islamists, his party, and the secular Tunisian new leaders been able to work together so well so far despite their issues? Jebali answered instantly, "We just set all that aside. We knew we had to concentrate on the economic problems because the voters are going to hold us responsible. If they are not fixed as soon as possible," which was a very good answer. Both sides knew if things were still in the big mess they are now, that with the elections 1 year out, their butts would be out on the street. They expect to be held accountable.
Ronald Reagan, maybe these emerging democracies can teach us older ones some things we may have forgotten or hidden away. We need to wise up and get these economic issues dealt with, or none of the others are going to matter in the end anyway. They had to get rid of the bloodsuckers first to get to even begin the job. We have some mega bloodsuckers sitting on the $4.5 trillion that Ronald Reagan and Lee Wanta wanted to rebuild America. We have 15,000 reads on our Saturday night column, but the media trucks are not parked outside my house yet, and I suspect they may be waiting to see if people even care. So, you know, you got to understand that this is probably the only, this is on Poor Richard's blog, but this may be the only news I've heard of the
revolt.
Of the revolt, yeah. I haven't heard of this, you know. So I just heard about it now.
Saudi funded, what was that?
Jihad, Syria, secular Arab state. This one I thought was interesting. Children just aren't going to know what sun is.
Let's go to the article.
So yeah. And it's kind of scary.
It's on climate research.
Yeah, climate research. And this is from a British newspaper, Telegraph.
James Dellingpool.
Okay.
There's a great piece
by David Rose
in the mail on Sunday, nicely summing up what a lot of us here knew already, that the thing we really need to fear right now is not global warming, but global cooling, and that, or current evidence, it's global cooling we're going to get. The supposed consensus on man-made global warming is facing an inconvenient challenge after release of new temperature data showing the planet has not warmed for the past 15 years. The figures suggest that we could even be heading for a mini ice age to rival the 70-year temperature drop that saw frost fairs held on the Thames in the 17th century. Based on readings from more than 30,000 measuring stations, the data was issued last week without fanfare by the Met Office and the University of East Anglia Climatic Research Unit. It confirms that the rising trend in the world temperatures ended in 1997.
Rose's piece comes hot on the heels of the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, signed by 16 distinguished scientists, proper ones, not climate scientists, noting the continuing absence of man, bear, pig. Okay.
I have no idea what that is.
I don't know what that is either, but perhaps the
star?
Perhaps the most inconvenient fact is the lack of global warming for well over 10 years now. This is known to the warming establishment, as one can see from the 2009 ClimateGate email of climate scientist Kevin Trenberth. The fact, he states that the fact is that we can't account for the lack of warming at the moment, and it's a travesty that we can't. But the warming is only missing if one believes computer models or so-called feedbacks involving water vapor and clouds greatly amplify the small effect of CO2. The lack of warming for more than a decade, indeed the smaller than predicted warmings over the last 22 years since the UN's Intergovernmental Plan on Climate Change began issuing projections, suggests that computer models have greatly exaggerated how much warming additional CO2 can cause. And faced with this embarrassment, those promoting alarm have shifted their drumbeat from warming to weather extremes to enable anything unusual that happens in our chaotic climate to be ascribed to CO2. The fact that CO2 is not a pollutant. CO2 is a colorless, odorless gas exhaled at high concentrations by each of us and a key component to the biosphere life cycle. Plants do so much better with more CO2 than that. Greenhouse operators often increase the CO2 concentrations by factors of 3 or 4 to get better growth. This is no surprise, since plants and animals evolved when CO2 concentrations were about 10 times larger than they are today.
Right.
Better plant varieties, chemical fertilizer, agricultural management contribute to the great increase in agricultural yields of the past century. But part of the increase almost certainly came from additional CO2 in the atmosphere. And
it's quite a long article.
Yeah. So, you know, actually it's not that long. But what he's saying is all, of course, all very, very true, which does rather invite the question, when's the scam going to end? When are all those climate scientists at institutions like the University of Easy Access finally going to eat crow? Well, actually, this question is entirely rhetorical, since I already know the answer. That's when hell freezes over. And consider, for example, the fate of Dr. David Viner, the University of Easy Access climatologist, responsible for the most read-ever story in the Independent, when in 2000 he famously deployed his meteorological expertise to tell children just aren't going to know what snow is. Okay? And where did Nostradamus Viner go? Well, for a time he has changed to disseminating climate change propaganda at taxpayer expense for the British Council. And it goes on a little bit, but he's kind of gotten extinguished. And
at the end of him, nobody cares.
So just so you know, we're ready for a climate freeze, not a climate warming. This is something that came up. This is a little long. I don't know if I want to play it that much, but it's really good. And I got another one, I think.
Which one is that?
This one here, where, you know, the reports commonly say that Bill Gates, though his philanthropic foundation work is saving lives and feeding the world's poor. In fact, the billionaire is made out to be almost the same. But actually, his whole thing is on eugenics.
Genocide, yeah.
But there's no mistaking the genocidal undertones. Hundreds of millions, if not billions, are living on the edge of starvation at the start of the 21st century. Well, a new era of GMO proliferation and big agro domination poses other grave threats, both economic and vital. Thus, it is extremely important that we collectively decide on the best solutions for the future, or at least avoid the worst outcomes. It could prove far too costly in hindsight to pander to the wrong development.
Why don't we play a little bit of that? I'd be interested in
that. It's about 15 minutes, so I'll play some of it.
Hmm.
And this is on Bill Gates Foundation, mastermind behind global eugenics.
It comes off as such
a saint.
Saying that we need to bring down the population and vaccines are going to help us do it. In fact, I think we have that clip now.
So let's look at each one of these and see how we can get this down to zero. Probably one of these numbers is going to have to get pretty near to zero.
This is Bill Gates.
Now that's back from high school algebra. But let's take a look. First, we've got population. The world today has 6.8 billion people. That's headed up to about 9 billion. Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, health care, reproductive health services, we could lower that by perhaps 10 or 15%.
Yeah.
And you notice the audience laughing there, too, how funny it is to use vaccines to lower the population, all this carbon tax nonsense about global warming. Now, Bill Gates is not just the genius inventor who came up with Microsoft or the personal computer. His father worked with Planned Parenthood since the 50s. They're a very wealthy family, multi-generational dynasty. They're part of the eugenics overall scheme, as are many of the computer companies. Both the Hewlett and Packard component of Hewlett-Packard both have foundations that donate heavily to eugenics. The Rockefeller Foundation, obviously, heavily involved. And here you see a nexus of Bill Gates and Rockefeller involved with the Gavi, the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization. They're pushing that worldwide. They're both involved in AGRA. If we could pull that back up there. They're both involved in AGRA. That is the Growing Africa's Agriculture Alliance, where essentially they're pushing GMOs and otherwise consolidating ownership of food crops. Bill Gates, we just covered how he's bought more than 500,000 shares in Monsanto more than a year and a half ago and really has a say in what that company does, all the things Monsanto is doing around the world, especially in the third world, how they're taking over agriculture here in the United States. You've got also the Rockefeller Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, both with stocks in the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, the so-called Doomsday Seed Vault, while they're pushing these destructive Monsanto Terminator seeds and everything else. And then you've got Bill Gates even owning a share in Cargill, one of the biggest big agro companies, big agriculture around the world. And the Rockefeller Foundation also works with Cargill on stuff like the Global Initiative for Food Systems. So you've got all these super big players increasingly controlling the world's food production. And here it is in the New York Times, buried on the third page, the struggle for daily bread. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are now the world's principal private funder of agriculture research. And they not only advise on food policy, but increasingly fund it. You've also got the London Guardian. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation investments in Monsanto and Cargill have come under heavy criticism. But why don't we hear more about why GMOs are dangerous, why they're killing people, why they're destroying agriculture systems in India and Africa? Is there a media conspiracy going on? That's something we wanted to explore here because you've got Bill Gates with a relationship with ABC News. It's reported in the Huffington Post, Bill and Melinda Gates sponsoring ABC News health coverage. It's also reported in the New York Times, the Gates Foundation backs the ABC News project. The Gates Foundation supplying $1.5 million and ABC is matching $4.5 million to travel the world and report on various health crises and suggest solutions, no doubt suggested in turn from the Gates Foundation and their worldwide medical complex. Now, they say, of course, there's no conflict of interest, and they're only paying for, you know, things like dinners and organizations and plane trips, but it really is influence. I mean, why do lobbyists take out politicians to dinner? I think we know the reason why. And so you've got stuff that we covered on Friday, like the ABC News article, Bill Gates using his money to save lives, fixing U.S. schools, reflecting on Steve Jobs, and it gets all into how he's going to save Africa and how you should be concerned about Africans and how their lives are so valuable, and that's why he's going to fund GMO crops for Africa, essentially forcing on them. And then buried at the very bottom of the article is the disclosure that the Bill and Gates Foundation supported in part ABC's news initiative, Be the Change, Save a Life. Now, it's good that they disclose that at all, but really they've got most of their viewers in the dark on the relationship there. You've got other stuff like this very article where it discloses and criticizes the Gates Foundation for owning Monsanto shares, and it's sponsored by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And so this article here illustrates the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's criticism and their ties to Monsanto and Cargill. At the same time, the story is sponsored by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as is this entire London Guardian blog. They have two different blogs they sponsor, the Global Development blog and the Poverty Matters blog. And while they talk about things like the fact that food prices are going up and that there's food crises compromising the fight against world hunger, and they disclose the fact that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are sponsoring these stories, the stories themselves do not get into the substance behind the facts of the way that mechanism works with the world's food industry. It's severe and significant and has very deep stuff. Even where they criticize them, they don't necessarily get into all the meat and potatoes, and by sponsoring the blog, they kind of have an editorial control, even though, of course, they tell us that, you know, it doesn't affect the editorial control, and it doesn't really matter that they're funding their blog with millions of dollars each year. But it's not just the London Guardian and ABC News. It's many, many, many other organizations, and I have another graphic here of the media-related grants from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as reported by the Seattle Times last year. There's at least 45 here. Many of them have multiple grants. Some of the big ones include BBC World News, All Africa, Columbia University, Johns Hopkins, National Public Radio, NPR, is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They have various medical paper writing organizations, lots of academic stuff, several organizations where they train members of the press and lead the press foundations, other universities, the Aspen Institute, the World Health Organization, all of these these are just grants they've given on media-related stuff, and the ABC and London Guardian's not even on this list, so we know there's going to be others that aren't here. Just to highlight the example of All Africa and BBC, All Africa is a pretty big website. I think it's probably the biggest consortium English-language website covering Africa news. And you tell me, are they critical of what the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Agra Alliance are doing in Africa to the farmers through this GMO partnership? Now, what does it mean when Bill Gates owns weather control companies, a share in the seed vault, and then pushes these knowingly dangerous GMOs on the world? Now, I wanted to go to a clip here where Bill Gates is criticizing Dr. Andrew Wakefield. We talked about a few weeks ago how he is now suing the journalist Brian Deer and the British Medical Journal for basically slandering him over his research study investigating the autism and vaccine link. And, of course, he doesn't actually say there is a link there. He's just investigating it. And, of course, it should be investigated. We shouldn't stop investigating it regardless of this one study shows. But let's go to the clip now where Bill Gates trashes him and says he has, a conflict of interest.
There's been a lot of scrutiny of vaccines recently, specifically childhood vaccines. There's been a lot of news about is there a connection with autism, for example. What do you make of all that? Dr. Wakefield wrote a paper about this saying that he thought there was a connection. What are your thoughts?
Well, Dr. Wakefield has been shown used absolutely fraudulent data. He had a financial interest in some lawsuits. He created a fake paper. The journal allowed it to run. All the other studies were done, showed no connection whatsoever.
So Bill Gates accuses Dr. Wakefield of using fraudulent data and of having financial interest in the study. But Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation fund people who write medical studies. They fund all kinds of things. They're the ones with the financial interest. Does he even know the term conflict of interest and how much his foundation is involved in? It's the number one eugenics funding foundation in the entire world, and there's more than 100 foundations involved in various eugenics-related programs. Now, meanwhile, the journalist who Dr. Wakefield is suing, who smeared his name, has ties to the British Medical Journal. And the Age of Autism blog says, should science betrayed BBC producer have disclosed his conflict of interest? They recycled the allegations of Brian Deer in the British Medical Journal against Andrew Wakefield, and one of the producers of the show, and Alexandra Feacham, is the daughter of the leading professional beneficiary of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Sir Richard Feacham. Sir Richard, in a letter to the British Medical Journal in 2009, in which he argued for public-private partnerships in global health and disclosed his relationship. And then they quote from the clip where Bill Gates says it is Wakefield with the conflict of interest. In another blog that is related to the Age of Autism, the Office of Medical and Scientific Justice, they point out how Brian Deer spoke at a French pharmaceutical conference just after attacking Wakefield. This week, journalist Brian Deer has been enjoying celebrity status at the luxury villa of Les Pinisseries of the Fondation Meru on the banks of Lake Agency in the French Alps. All three MMR vaccine manufacturers were in attendance, who were involved in litigation, GSK, Merck, and Sanofi, and the Bill and Melinda Gates was there. And Brian Deer was the keynote speaker and otherwise was at the conference. So far, Deer has disclosed no pharmaceutical sponsorship or hospitality ties in his series of British Medical Journal articles attacking Andrew Wakefield. So that's another thing to look at with the whole Wakefield scandal and who really has the conflict of interest. You judge for yourself. I'm not going to be the one to tell you. Meanwhile, you've got FDA staffers suing the agency over surveillance of personal email. Now, it alleges that, in this article from the Washington Post, that several employees of the Food and Drug Administration had tried to warn Congress the agency was approving medical devices they believed pose unacceptable risk to patients, government documents show. What did this lead to? Information garnered this way eventually contributed to the harassment or dismissal of all six FDA employees, the suit alleges. All had worked in the office responsible for reviewing devices for cancer screening and purposes. That is after they surveilled their personal emails, memos, and other information. And that's what happens when you try to warn about dangerous devices inside the FDA. They go after the employees who want to warn people. Very interesting. Now, furthermore, on the GMO subject, you've got people in India trying to sue and stop the GMO thing from happening. There's been all the studies showing the cancer links, the links to sterility, the organ failure. It's also ruining the agricultural business and really putting farmers around the world in a straitjacket mentality. And it's very terrible for those people. Let's play that clip now.
Leo Saldana filed a complaint that led to India charging American agricultural giant Monsanto with biopiracy. And the eggplant, or brinjal, is what the company is accused of stealing. Leo says Monsanto illegally used indigenous brinjal varieties to create a genetically modified version of the vegetable.
So there are six varieties taken from Karnataka, which Monsanto has taken without any conformance with the Biological Diversity Act, and therefore it is biopiracy. And once they put the BT gene into brinjal, then it becomes a commodity, which is essentially owned by Monsanto.
Now, you see there again the problems that Monsanto is causing around the world. Bill Gates has the shares in it. And because Bill Gates decided to attack, at least what appears to me on the surface to be an honest researcher who was trying to just warn parents that vaccines could have a link with autism and that further research should be done, and that Bill Gates says he's the one saving lives and that vaccines and GMOs around the world are the answer to that, well, we're going to give him the Skeksis Award tonight. Just for that media conflict of interest and the whole deal. I mean, really, more focus should be put on this man right here. Do your own research. I'm not telling you exactly what's going on here. I'm telling you as much as I know, and I'm telling you it deserves further research, but certainly a Dark Cretin Award for you. Now, we have a quote of the day, and then Alex's extended interview with Nomi Prince is coming up on the other side of the break. A government big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take away everything you have. That's Barry Goldwater. He also warned about the Trilateral Commission and the whole globalist agenda, so check out his work as well. Stay tuned.
I hope you enjoyed that. I thought that was pretty...
kind of enlightening, I thought.
A lot of information. And, you know, we can't give you enough stuff, I swear to God. Anyway, there's a couple other things that are pressing here that I wanted to bring up. This I thought was interesting. Virginia officials confirm a criminal election fraud investigation of Gingrich campaign.
Previously when he was speaker?
Presently.
Yeah.
And this is Brad Blog, but about his Virginia, what he tried to do to get on the ballot in Virginia, which failed, but he actually breached criminal issues. And this is from bradblog.com, which is, he specializes in election fraud.
Yeah, and he also likes to grab the attention, too.
What?
He likes to grab the attention by things that he says.
Right.
Yes.
Well, of course.
He gets right out there and he brings it right out.
So exclusive Virginia officials confirm criminal election fraud investigation of Gingrich campaign. Had the same thing been carried out by a worker for the now-defunct Acorn Republicans, and even Newt Gingrich would have called it a massive voter fraud. But the 1,500 acts of fraud, by Gingrich's own admission, were carried out by a worker hired by his campaign. So it seems the media have barely noticed it.
And they don't seem to be interested.
They don't care. They don't care. The media they don't care about any voter fraud. Nonetheless, the Brad blog has received confirmation from two different state agencies that the 1,500 alleged cases of ballot petition fraud said to have been carried out on behalf of the Gingrich campaign in their unsuccessful attempt to qualify for the Republican primary ballot in Virginia are now being carried out by the state attorney general's office. That's going to be an interesting kill.
Mm-hmm.
In late December, after Gingrich had failed to turn in enough valid signatures to qualify for Virginia's primary ballot, he was caught on videotape telling a supporter in Iowa that the reason for the failure was due to a campaign worker who created 1,500 fraudulent signatures.
Oh.
We turned in 11,100. We needed 10,000. 1,500 of them were by one guy who frankly committed fraud, Gingrich is seen and heard saying in video originally aired by CNN. You admitted it. And the former Speaker of U.S. House of Representatives downplayed the incident by explaining to women, to the woman, that the entire affair was a mistake. But after they had hired somebody who turned in false signatures. Neither he nor his campaign, however, has made the name of the alleged one guy public. To our knowledge, despite the extraordinary number of fraudulent signatures created and turned in by the one guy, and what is official in Virginia State Board of Elections described to us as definitely an illegal act.
Huh.
And news of the embarrassing criminal investigation is confirmed today, even as voters go to the polls on Florida for Florida's 2012 primary, where Gingrich is facing off against frontrunner Mitt Romney. And comfortable enough for the Republicans, may also find himself the subject of a criminal voter fraud investigation.
Oh, really?
In the not-too-distant future. Yeah, isn't that funny? Gingrich fraud investigation says mid-January in a little-noticed blog item by the Washington Post, it was reported that SBE was...
what's that?
I'm not sure. I was requesting a probe by the Office of Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccellini with the SBE chairman, Charles Judd. I don't know what SBE stands for.
No.
I hate it when they give you these damn things. And State Board of Elections. Virginia State Board of Elections. That's what SBE stands for. And last week, the SBE Deputy Secretary, Justin Reamer, confirmed to BradBlog both the referral to the AG's Attorney General's office as well as the fact that an investigation into the ballot petition fraud was officially being carried out. We're not an investigative body, but this issue has been referred to the Attorney General. And it goes on. It's a pretty long article, very long article, actually. So you might want to go to it. And it's on bradblog.com, right? So check that out. I recommend it. We've had Brad on our show quite a few times over the many years. And, let's see if I can get... this is something nobody's heard about. Very, very little news on this. And it was a very, very difficult, very big earthquake in Peru. And I'm very surprised nobody's touched on it. But this is scores are injured as a 6.3 magnitude earthquake hit Lima, Peru. Powerful earthquake injures scores of people.
Wow. Where is that?
In Lima, Peru.
And there was not one mention.
No, not in the mainstream.
I didn't hear anything.
Not in the mainstream. You want to read that?
Sure. See if I can see it. In black. A powerful earthquake injured scores of people, buckled buildings, and caused power outages on the coast south of Lima early Monday morning, with no immediate reports of fatalities, officials said. Most people were injured when they fled their homes in panic. I don't blame them. I'd be scared, too. Or when they were struck by collapsing walls. Memories are still fresh of the powerful... Whoops, I missed a thing. The epicenter of the magnitude 6.3 quake, which struck 11 minutes after midnight on Sunday, was 15 miles southeast of the city of Ica, the U.S. Geological Survey said. Memories are still fresh of the powerful 8.0 magnitude earthquake that struck the Ica region on August 15, 2007, killing more than 500 people and injured about 200,000. While residents remain jittery, there were no known fatalities on Monday, civil defense officials said. However, 145 people were injured, and most were taken to hospital, though the injuries were mostly minor. The quake also destroyed 125 homes and damaged 581 buildings. Most people were injured when they fled their homes in panic or when they were struck by collapsing walls, said Raul Human with the Ica Regional Hospital. Among the damaged buildings was the Cathedral of Ica, which had already been damaged in 2007 quake. The jolt caused people to flee their homes. The port of Pisco and the town of Palpa, Nazca, and Cante. Dozens of Ica residents spent the night in parks and gardens fearing aftershocks. The quake epicenter depth was 24 miles. The reading was based on the open-ended monument magnitude scale used by U.S. seismologists, which means the area of the fault that ruptured and the total energy released. Peru is in the Pacific Ring of Fires, which is the site of 85% of the global seismic activity. I didn't realize that.
No, but they had one. You remember the miners down there and all that?
Yeah.
Oh, no, that was Chile, I think. Was it Chile or Peru?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I mean, see how we forget stuff, you know?
Yeah,
it's so easy
I think
to
it's
forget.
It was Chile.
And,
but maybe not.
Yeah, Chile, I think. I should go through that. We got about 7 minutes left.
Teenagers, this is a scary one. Teenagers turn their backs on university education.
This is in England, but it's the same here.
Costs so much to borrow money.
That is so excruciating. My God.
And then you can't get a job when you finish.
Yeah, I mean,
so
you get out of school, you own $100,000, you know.
Or more.
Yeah, and student loans. You can't file bankruptcy. Because you can't file bankruptcy.
And you're in debt for life, so you're a slave.
Slave, you know. Teenagers turn their backs on university education. This is from.
What is that?
I don't even know where this is from.
Independent.
Yeah, the Independent. This is English.
Universities have suffered the steepest fall in applications since records began, with the total number of students seeking places this autumn plummeting by 8.7% as the true impact of a tuition fee increase was felt. Last night, there were warnings that the decline would lead to course closure and redundancies at campuses across the country. An even more marked drop of 9.9% was recorded in applications from students in England, where fees are rising up to £9,000 a year. More men than women have been discouraged from applying, with their numbers falling by 8.5% to
230,342 figures from universities and college admissions.
Yeah. There are 309,731 female applicants, down 6.7% fewer than at this time last year. A subject-by-subject breakdown reveals that courses suffering the worst declines include non-European languages such as Japanese and Mandarin, which are often cited as being vital to the future of the British economy. Applications to these courses are down 21.5%. Creative arts and design courses are down more than 16%, and technology by 17%. The only degrees to register an increase are some medicine courses, including nursing, which are up 2%.
In all, there are 43,473 fewer applications for degree courses starting in autumn 2012 than there were last year. Now, this is only in England,
yeah.
All right? But that's carrying over into this country as well, and, And it's remarkable what's happening, just because people cannot afford this. You can't afford it. I went to college. Lila went to college, but we never had that kind of staggering debt.
My parents were middle class people, and they could afford to pay for my tuition.
Well, you were lucky. I had to pay for my own, and my own was but it was within reason that I could do it. You know what I mean?
My parents saved.
I was working and paying, going into the school at the same time, and I was able to afford it. But you know, it was not, you know, $20,000 a year, you know, for tuition.
No.
You know, it was $36,000 or, you know, $1,500 a year for college tuition. That was without, of course, school room and board. But, you know,
I was able to pay for my master's and it didn't cost a fortune.
And here we go. Occupy Unmoved. That's a good way to end the show tonight. Occupy Wall Street. D.C., rather, gets eviction notice, but prepares to stand up against police.
Here we are.
I think that's a good way to end. Let's keep standing.
Anti-corporate protesters from the Occupy Wall Street movement in Washington are gearing up for a tough police action. They have passed the deadline set up by local authorities to remove camping equipment from the city squares. But our chief Liz Wall discovered the activists are remaining loyal to the cause.
So we are here at McPherson Square, where protesters have been occupying the park since October. Throughout the demonstration, about 100 tents have been pitched here. The National Park Service has repeatedly slapped these notices on tents here at McPherson Square, informing protesters that they can no longer camp out here. That means they have to get rid of sleeping bags and any other material which allows them to live here. Protesters are responding by painting that symbol on the notice, which demonstrates the fact that they do not agree with this mandate. Their tents can stay, but their doors must remain open, proving no one is living in it. The notice warns protesters that violate the rule are subject to arrest.
It's basically a symbol of opposition to, you know, what everything that this movement is opposing right now. And so I think the tents are a really important part of Occupy.
But police presence was sparse, with no reported arrests. They stand mostly on the sidelines, refusing to answer questions from the media. But occupiers made their message loud and clear. They are not giving up the fight.
As you can see, protesters have erected a massive tent over the statue here at McPherson Park. It's all in demonstration to the anticipated eviction by park police.
This is our tent of dreams. We want to be able to sleep here so we can dream of a better world where everyone has access to health care, education, housing, and where the rich and corporations and banks no longer have control of our political system.
The federal government and the political leaders and Wall Street were all tone deaf. They could not hear this, so the Occupy movement has offered them a hearing aid, and they're getting our message loud and clear now.
The purpose of this was to unite us in this space, so if they want to arrest one of us, they have to arrest all of us or none of us.
In Washington, Liz Wall, RT.
That's a good way to end the show. I give those people a lot of credit.
I do, too. And with that, please join me tomorrow night when I get into the fourth-dimensional state of mind.
Well, that'll be good, Leo. And then
Friday night with
join
George
us Friday with George Dixon.
Yep.
And we hope you enjoy the rest of your evening, folks.
And good night.
Good night.